Hi, friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is July 19, 1976, and this is my monthly audio letter number 14. What I am forced to tell you about today is grave and urgent beyond description. I believe you have a right and a need to know about it. And yet, I already know that in all likelihood, and you will not believe me when I tell you, because it is something no one wants to believe. I've wrestled with this thing, wondering how best to tell you what you must be told. But all I can say is that it is absolutely true, beyond any shadow of a doubt. I stake my entire life and my reputation on this fact. If there were any doubt at all about what I am about to reveal, I would not reveal it. At this very moment, the United States of America is teetering on the precipice of a devastating nuclear surprise attack, the likes of which the world has never seen. If the detailed plans for war that I have already told you about are carried out, as discussed especially in my monthly audio letters number 6, 12, and 13, this attack might not come for as much as another year or even more. But that is a very big if, because the capability for this attack is now in place, and it includes provisions for a Soviet double-cross of their allies, the four Rockefeller brothers, who now rule America behind the scenes. Today, I want to alert you to the terrible threat we face by means of these topics. Topic number one, the Soviet missile crisis of 1976. Topic number two, Hitler's pattern for America's bicentennial era. And topic number three, the plans for America's future under occupation and dictatorship. Topic number one. It was a sleepy Sunday morning in Hawaii nearly 35 years ago when World War II came to America. Much of the Pacific Fleet of the United States Navy was peacefully at anchor, suspecting nothing, while President Franklin D. Roosevelt and his closest advisors, far away in Washington, D.C., waited anxiously for the attack to occur as planned. At 7:55 a.m. on that peaceful Sunday morning, December 7, 1941, more than 100 Japanese aircraft suddenly appeared in the skies over the island of Oahu, Hawaii. All attempts to warn the Navy of the impending attack had been thwarted or delayed, and the bottled-up American fleet was torn to shreds as a result of the complete surprise that resulted. FDR and his closest advisors had made sure that no aircraft carriers were caught in the raid, because these would be indispensable in the retaliation to come against Japan. Instead, the sacrifice was limited to battleships, destroyers, cruisers, and several thousand American servicemen's lives. Soon the news of the crushing disaster that had befallen the United States Navy flashed across a stunned and unbelieving America, and the words Pearl Harbor from that day have been a synonym for surprise attack of the most catastrophic variety. It should also bring to mind high treason and intrigue, because while most Americans were trying to recover from the shock and horror of the Pearl Harbor attack, FDR and his Rockefeller bosses were congratulating themselves on the success of the operation. The United States would now be drawn into the war against Hitler, enabling a Rockefeller takeover of the formerly British oil concessions in Saudi Arabia. Yet President Roosevelt would be making good on his campaign promises not to send American boys away to die in a foreign war. Instead, he had arranged to get us into war by allowing several thousand American boys to die in a rigged attack on American territory, Pearl Harbor. His renowned Day of Infamy speech then galvanized the nation overnight into a fighting mood. The obstacle of American isolationist sentiment had been flattened, and the United States was at war. Today, we are once again at the mercy of an imminent Pearl Harbor-type attack. As before, we are being given no warning whatever that this is the case, aside from the general level of tensions here and abroad. But this time, it has been planned to be far worse, because this time the plan is not for America to win the war, but to lose it. 2 months ago, in monthly audio letter number 12, I first revealed the existence of a super-secret nuclear-safe zone, a swath across roughly the upper half of the continental United States between the latitudes of 40 and 50 degrees north. According to secret agreements between the Rockefeller brothers and their Soviet allies, this zone is supposed to be spared from the all-out thermonuclear war that is planned to engulf the southern half of the United States in Nuclear War I. This arrangement has three purposes. First, as I revealed 2 months ago, it provides a zone within which the Rockefeller brothers and their closest collaborators expect to ride out the coming Nuclear War I in safety and comfort. Second, much of the industrial base and agricultural breadbasket of America will be preserved for exploitation after the war. A third factor, which I did not mention before, has to do with a high-altitude jet stream which goes clear around the Earth. Should the Soviets find it necessary to back up their so-called clean bombs, which I revealed last month, with the older dirty bombs, they don't want radioactive fallout from America to drift around the Earth and land on the Soviet Union. More than 95% of the Soviet Union lies north of the 40th parallel of latitude. So by agreeing with the Rockefeller brothers to strike America only below that latitude, except for a small strike against Alaska, the Soviets have avoided the danger of having much radioactive dust from America circle the globe to land on their own country. But the Soviets are very eager to break free of the Rockefeller control under which they have functioned for so long, and they are preparing a double cross. As I reported last month in monthly audio letter number 13, the safe zone agreement has been violated by the placement of an atomic bomb at Seal Harbor, Maine, to blast the summer homes of Nelson and David Rockefeller off the map. But that, I am sorry to report, is only the beginning of the Pearl Harbor the Soviets have prepared for us. The Soviet double cross of the Rockefeller brothers is to be thorough and complete, and it will include several more violations of their nuclear safe zone, an acceptable price in Soviet eyes for breaking free of the Rockefellers and into the position of absolute world supremacy themselves. While the United States has focused its missile development on long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles, the Soviet Union has never forgotten the potentialities of shorter-range missiles, which are easier to design and build. That's what the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962 was all about. The Soviets, not wishing to depend on their long-range missiles, had installed much shorter-range missiles in Cuba, able to reach many American cities from the vulnerable South. And when President John F. Kennedy spoiled the Rockefeller Soviet plans by forcing Nikita Khrushchev to remove them, they did not abandon this idea. Instead, JFK was removed from the scene himself, and his replacement, Rockefeller puppet President John Lyndon B. Johnson, handed the Soviets a new site for the emplacement of medium-range missiles to threaten the United States from the South. This was done by turning over the huge United States-built Mackenzie Airfield to the newly independent Marxist Republic of Guyana. The Americans pulled out. Mackenzie Airfield was renamed the Temara Airfield, And this new air base, the largest in Central or South America, was then fortified by ringing it with nuclear missiles aimed at the Panama Canal and cities in the southern half of the United States. And as I have been reporting for over 2 years, without any government investigation of my charges whatsoever, the missiles in Guyana are at operational readiness today, threatening the United States and the Panama Canal. But that's not all, my friends. 5 years ago, in 1971, there was another Soviet missile crisis, this time involving both Canada and the United States, and I am here revealing it for the very first time. The Soviet missile crisis of 1971 began with an accidental discovery by some divers off Vancouver Island, Canada. A Vancouver fishing trawler had sunk in the area, and divers were sent down to locate it. While they were looking, they came across something unbelievable, a missile anchored to the bottom. It was attached by heavy chains to four concrete blocks, each estimated to weigh 5 tons. The blocks, in turn, were anchored to the bottom by extra-heavy anchors of Soviet design. The divers reported their unexpected find immediately, and the North American Air Defense Command, NORAD, went into action. The Canadian ship HCMS Risiguchi, plus 2 mine layers and a torpedo boat were dispatched and immediately covered the area. By coincidence, this chance discovery occurred just as the Soviet Navy was launching its own operation to recover that very missile. Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko had just arrived to visit Vancouver for a hush-hush foreign ministers' conference, ostensibly. Strangely, he arrived aboard the Soviet ship Suvorov, a heavy cruiser of the Cresta class. But Gromyko explained that away by saying that he had just been inspecting the Soviet fleet, which was on maneuvers. But that was just a cover story. A Soviet oceanographic research ship doing underwater experiments on guided missiles near Sakhalin had reached the conclusion that 6 guided missiles, which had been placed strategically on the seabed around the North American continent years before, would now have to be recovered and removed at once. These had been planted on the orders of Khrushchev after his defeat by President Kennedy in the Cuban Missile Crisis, and for years they had been lurking undetected. But now they would have to be removed because the Soviet experiments at Sakhalin had revealed that the metals used in the missiles were proving unstable and had started disintegrating rapidly in the salt water. The situation was very serious, not only because the missiles were no longer dependable as weapons, but also because corrosion of the warheads could have led to leakage of radioactive materials or even, under certain conditions, uncontrolled explosions. This was the real reason for Gromyko's strange visit to Vancouver aboard the heavy cruiser Suvorov in 1971. The Soviet Navy, in reality, was invading the territorial waters of Canada to recover a malfunctioning weapon, the underwater missile. But due to the accidental discovery of the missile by the Canadian divers, Gromyko's mission was foiled. He stayed there for 3 days aboard the ship and then was aghast to see the Soviet missile go past him on a barge on the way to dockside. Gromyko immediately canceled his appearance in Vancouver and sailed for home without delay. The missile itself was rushed by a special airplane immediately to a secret location in the United States for study and analysis. The Vancouver discovery also triggered an intensive search of all the American and Canadian coasts by specially equipped surface and underwater vessels. This search turned up 3 more such missiles, one off the coast of California and Oregon, another just south of San Rosero, Baja California, and a third one off the coast of Maine, just east of a rocky island there. 2 additional underwater missiles were known to exist as well, One was believed to be somewhere in the arc from Cuba to Pensacola, Florida. The other was thought to be in the Caribbean islands, aimed at the Panama Canal. These last two were never found by the United States Navy, but the pattern of activity of the Soviet Navy indicated that they were successfully recovered by the Soviets. The Soviets had been poised to mount a recovery operation for all six missiles, but were prevented from making any such attempt because of the intensive United States Navy search. Each of the four missiles which were recovered by the joint Canadian-American effort was examined and its targets determined. It turned out that each missile was fitted with multiple warheads. The one discovered by the divers off Vancouver had six targets: the Royal Canadian Naval Base on Vancouver Island, the Port of Vancouver, the Port of Seattle, and three Boeing aircraft plants in Seattle, Everett, and Blaine. The missile found off the coast of Oregon in California had its multiple warheads targeted on five centers in the San Francisco Bay Area. The San Rosario missile was targeted on the United States Naval Base of San Diego and on the city of Los Angeles. As for the missile found in the waters off the coast of Maine, its targets were Boston, the submarine base in Connecticut, the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and the New York Harbor. The missile, which was apparently retrieved by the Soviets in the Cuba-Pensacola area, was assumed to have been aimed at strategic coastal targets in the southeast. And so ended the Soviet missile crisis of 1971. In some respects, it was even more dangerous than the Cuban missile crisis 9 years earlier, because the underwater missiles off our shores were already operational, whereas those in Cuba were stopped just short of operational status. But you've never heard a word about the Soviet missile crisis of 1971. This is because that would not have squared well with our official policy of so-called détente with the Soviet Union. The Rockefeller agents in our government knew all about the missiles and had a ticklish job keeping the lid on after the accidental discovery by the Vancouver divers brought NORAD and the United States Navy into the picture. All's well that ends well, or so it seems, but this just wasn't the end of the Soviet missile crisis. On February 11, 1971, the same year in which the Soviet missile crisis occurred, 63 nations signed a treaty prohibiting installation of nuclear weapons on the seabed beyond any nation's 12-mile coastal zone. On top of that, the United States over the past dozen years has laid down a grid of electronic sensing wires and cables on the ocean floor all along both our Pacific and Atlantic coasts, making the seabed look like a giant spider web. These detection nets, called SOSUS for the Atlantic and CSAR for the Pacific, are tied into computers which enable any submarine passing over them, American or foreign, to be detected, located, and even identified in a very short time. So, what could happen? My friends, the Maginot Line did not protect the French from invasion in World War II. The Germans went right over it. In the same way, the Rockefeller brothers have enabled the Soviets to go over our underwater detection nets as if they did not exist. When President Richard M. Nixon arrived in Moscow on May 22, 1972, for summit talks with the Kremlin, he had more to discuss than the highly publicized SALT talks. A key agreement arrived at then established joint oceanographic projects with the Soviets, and since that time, Soviet oceanographic vessels have been in and out of our territorial waters continuously. For approximately 2 years, these vessels operated in a totally innocent appearing fashion while actually gathering information on optimum placement sites for a new fleet of underwater missiles along our shores. By the time the joint Army-Navy teams monitoring the underwater nets had become accustomed to the Soviet oceanographic ships as a routine, non-threatening presence in our waters, the Soviets were ready to act. Under cover of oceanographic operations, the Soviets began planting underwater missiles along our shores once again, plus several strategically located atomic bombs. And as if they needed it, the Soviets have also slipped in through a loophole in the 1971 treaty, which superficially seems to ban such weaponry in our coastal waters. Most, if not all, of these weapons have been planted inside our 12-mile territorial limit, whereas the treaty only forbids such things beyond that limit. This is a chilling echo of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's promises to avoid a foreign war before World War II, only to help rig an attack on our own territory. But the Soviets, having been given the oceanographic cover they needed in order to get the bombs and missiles into our coastal waters, have already double-crossed their Rockefeller allies. Not only have the Rockefeller brothers themselves been marked for destruction, as signaled by the bomb at Seal Harbor, Maine, but their precious nuclear-safe zone has already been breached by the Soviets in at least three other places where missiles have been placed contrary to their agreement with the Rockefellers. The Soviets, like the Rockefeller brothers themselves, are now going for broke. They are trying to arrange in every way they can to break the back of any conceivable retaliation or resistance by the United States in the coming war. It is still in the Soviet interest to minimize warfare within the nuclear-safe zone. But specific targets will be attacked within this zone whenever the Soviets consider it necessary to achieve their goal of total victory and total world domination over the United States. I can now reveal that the coastal waters of the United States, including Alaska, Hawaii, and the Panama Canal Zone, now contain at least 10 multiple warhead short-range underwater launch missiles of a new advanced design. In addition, at least 4 atomic bombs have been strategically placed in harbor areas. Here is the situation as it now stands, according to my own latest intelligence sources. First, the 4 bombs. One is the bomb I was able to reveal last month, which is placed at Seal Harbor, Maine, to destroy the summer homes of David and Nelson Rockefeller. The second is planted in the Potomac River near the United States Naval Ordnance Station at Indian Head, Maryland. The third is in the Mississippi River upstream from New Orleans in the vicinity of Benet Carey Spillway and Floodway. And the fourth atomic bomb has been planted in the port of Valdez, Alaska, which is the southern terminus of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. By rendering the port of Valdez useless, of course, the pipeline will be put out of action, since oil tankers are supposed to carry the oil from the pipeline delivery point at Valdez to destinations in the lower United States. As for the short-range multiple warhead Soviet missiles, which once again infest our coastal waters, 3 violate the nuclear-safe zone. One is in Boston Harbor. The second is in Long Island Sound, about midway between New York City and the submarine base at New London, Connecticut. And the third is in the Seattle-Vancouver area, situated between Victoria, British Columbia on the north and the Port Angeles or Sequim, Washington area on the south. Outside the nuclear-safe zone, missile number 4 is in Chesapeake Bay, east of Washington, D.C. Number 5 is located just offshore from Pensacola, Florida. A 6th missile has been planted in Galveston Bay, Texas. A 7th lies just offshore of San Diego, California, while missile number 8 is deep inside San Pablo Bay, near San Francisco. The 9th missile is located in the Atlantic Ocean, near the north entrance to the Panama Canal. And finally, missile number 10, with tragic irony, is poised in the Pacific Ocean, near the entrance to Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. The exact location of the Pearl Harbor missile is longitude 157 degrees, 58 minutes, 58 seconds. Latitude 21 degrees, 18 minutes, 28 seconds. All the Navy needs to do is to look, and do it now, before the Soviets have time to sneak in and move it, and they'll find this missile. I respectfully urge, no, I demand, that the Joint Chiefs of Staff immediately take such actions as are required to remove the deadly missiles which now menace the United States and Vancouver, Canada, from our own territorial waters. The things I have just revealed are true, my friends, and I urge you to add your challenge to mine. I stand ready to cooperate fully with the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the new, larger Soviet missile crisis we are now in. Will the Joint Chiefs act? If they do not do so, and soon, then they themselves will have violated their oath to protect and safeguard our Constitution, our nation, our lives, and the lives of generations to come.